Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to UFO Think Tank with your host, Alejandro Rojas.
There's the theme music, and I know how excited you all get when you hear it, because it means it's another episode of UFO Think Tank. Hello, people. This is your host, Alejandro T. Rojas, and we've got a great guest, of course. We always have great guests, and this is another guest who's going to be a speaker at the Roswell Festival next weekend. The crowds go wild because I've had just about everybody who's going to be speaking at the Roswell Festival on my show. I am coordinating this speakers conference, and I'm very proud of that. I've done a heck of a job, people, putting this together. Man, have I been busy. I just hope it goes smooth. Hopefully, you know, you can put it all together and everything can go smooth, and then it's a disaster when you get there. Hopefully that won't be the case. Knock on, my desk is made out of glass, unfortunately. But hopefully it's going to go well. It's going to be a lot of fun. You know, these are great people. So even if a dozen things get screwed up per hour, that's a lot. I think these are friends who will put up with it. They're good sports, and they're just here to get the information out. But I'm sure my good buddies, Free Ward, Amy Ward, Renee, all of these wonderful people that work for the city of Roswell, they are absolutely wonderful. They've been doing a great job putting things together. Free and Amy have been working so hard. Peter Robbins, who I've had on the show, he's been working real hard to get all this together. We're going to be partying with Jefferson Starship. All right. So we're going to have a good time out there. It's going to be a lot of fun. And I know some of you listeners are going to make it. And maybe some of you have not decided to go next weekend. And you know what? Now's the time to just say, I got to do this. Get out there. Grab a tent. Come on out. There is campground out there. You know, if you need to, just kind of park on the side of the road and sleep in your car. You're going to want to be there because it's going to be a lot of fun. And we're going to have a lot of great speakers, including our guests this evening. Dr. Donald Burleson. What a history this guy has. He is a mathematician. Obviously, he's also interested in the paranormal. He's MUFON state director, actually, for New Mexico. But he's also an English. His PhD is in English. He's done mathematics. He's worked at the University of New Mexico. He held a top secret clearance with U.S. Air Force Intelligence as a Chinese language specialist. He's also fluent in Spanish and a reading knowledge of French. I mean, this guy sounds like a super genius. Really intelligent guy, done a lot of stuff. And he's got a couple books out there, so he's an accomplished author as well. He has a book on Marilyn Monroe and her death related to UFOs. We'll talk a lot about that. And then he's also got another book, and that's what he's going to be talking about in Roswell, which is Oppenheimer and his connection with UFOs, and specifically he will be talking in Roswell about Oppenheimer's connection to Roswell. So Oppenheimer saw these Roswell beings or this crash or something? I don't know. I haven't seen his talk yet. So we will find out. And you know what? I'm going to be honest with you people right now. I'm not going to get into the Oppenheimer stuff much. You're going to have to come to Roswell to hear it. So is that so much to ask? Come on. If you hop in the car right now, you can make it. If you're even if you're on the other side of the country, Grant Cameron, one of our speakers from Canada, has decided to drive. He's just leaving today. If he can get there from Canada, you can get there from wherever you are. Take the Greyhound, for God's sakes, people. That's only a few bucks. But come on out to Roswell and check it out. It's going to be a lot of fun. And in fact, I've got a little homage to Roswell in just a minute. But first, the UFOs in the news segment. There's been a lot of, as usual, there's a lot of UFO stuff in the news. I don't think I covered this with you all last weekend because I just found out, I just posted it on Sunday. And that is a new movie starring George Clooney called Men Who Stare at Goats. And it's kind of out, it's about psychic research that the military did. And the reason I bring it up here is because it is loosely based on George Clooney's character. And it's going to be a dark comedy. I said, unfortunately, a dark comedy, and someone jumped my case. Just kidding. He didn't jump my case. He just had a great question. He said, well, you know, can't we be funny in ufology? And I said, no. This is serious business. If you're not going to be serious, hit the road. Hit the skids. Just kidding. Obviously, I'm being silly because I try to add humor into my show here. I do my best. Some of you may find it annoying, and I apologize if that's the case, but hopefully some of you do find me at least a little bit amusing. It adds to my charm, I like to think. But yeah, I certainly think that, you know, I think of Ghostbusters, which was a movie about paranormal, and that was hilarious. I think some of the real funny X-Files, like I told them, I think your protagonist just needs to probably be, you know, like a researcher or someone into it, especially. The reason I said unfortunately about this movie is because it's going to be a dark comedy. And the title, Men Who Stare at Goats, it gives me the sense they're going to make fun of this. Because the reason I think they really had some projects where they had a guy staring at goats is they were trying to kill him with their mind, which is unfortunate. And it's certainly, for any of you people with psychic abilities or you're discovering your psychic abilities, use it for good. Please don't go kill goats or other innocent animals, used to make people feel better, you know? That would be the right way to use it, I think. But this guy, John Alexander, unfortunately works for the military. He's been in intelligence, and I don't think he uses his powers for good. He may feel differently, so just a difference of opinion. He is actually into non-lethal weapons. He is into psychic. They had him look into the psychic stuff. He's into UFOs as well, but he says that the government doesn't know anything about UFOs. Roswell didn't happen. We're all just as curious as you all, but I do believe they exist. So he also, along with his non-lethal weapons stuff, oh, excuse me, people, my goodness. He is into the brain stuff, you know, manipulating people's by influence and stuff like that. So some shady stuff kind of, you know. So, but he is into UFOs. He goes to UFO conferences and talks about how the military is innocent and doesn't know anything about all of this stuff. Who knows? Other people feel that way as well. I don't, but I'd be really surprised. I think they know a lot. More news. Multiple witnesses watched UFO dropping lights on the ground right here in Colorado. I didn't see it, but I'm going to keep my eyes open. Triangular-shaped UFOs over Arizona have been being seen, and all the rest of these stories, I think, were brought to us by Roger Marsh, the UFO Examiner at examiner.com. Does a great job. Some more stories he brought, UFOs being seen over airports. Jets possibly chasing UFOs in New Mexico. We'll keep my eyes out for that next weekend. and an Exeter UFO Festival coming up here. So that ought to be a lot of fun. That's going to be late June, June 24th. Also, a couple other stories that weren't from him. I got a message from Robert Hastings. Robert Hastings is the author of UFOs and Nukes. He's been on Larry King. He actually wrote a book about UFOs seeming to visit nuclear facilities, including, if you've heard of, the Maelstrom Air Force Base, where people claim that they turned off the nukes for a period of time. He's going to be on Larry King, along with James Fox, another researcher. He's going to have a couple other people on. Unfortunately, he's going to have his skeptics. He's going to have Phil What's-His-Face and Bill Nye. And we would, I think they get ridiculous. If they would at least look into this stuff and argue exact points, that would be helpful. But they just make these blanket statements, which is unfortunate. But, yeah, July 3rd, Larry King will have UFOs on again. So keep an eye out for that. If you're in Roswell, like most of you are, you know, let's get together. We'll go somewhere and watch this together, huh? Let's make it a date. And let's see, one more story that I had here was NASA and UFOs. Just an interesting story in American Chronicle where he felt that some of the research and opening up that NASA is doing in their research is going to force them to look into UFOs. I hope he's right. We'll see. Check out his story on American Chronicle. Remember, you can see all of these stories at UFOthinktankbot.com. Scroll down on the very front page. You will see these news links. Also, if you're at the Blog Talk site, on the right-hand side of my homepage, you'll see a link to my Yahoo News. You can also go to Yahoo Groups and look for a UFO Think Tank there and join my email list. And that's the best thing to do because you will get these stories, boom, boom, right on the spot, and you will be up to date on everything happening. You don't want to read about your neighbors getting sucked out of their house by a UFO from me on Saturday when you could have heard about it when it happened and you know, battened down the hatches and watched out for that. So check it out. That's the news. Also, this is big news for UFO Think Tank, and I'm very happy about this. I was on Joe Montaldo's show recently. Joe Montaldo runs the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. And this guy, holy moly, gets hundreds of thousands of listeners. He's on satellite radio in Australia and other countries. So there are lots of people in other countries who've got, they've got his station on all day long. Well, he's going to syndicate my show. So UFO Paranormal Radio, he's going to be playing me on his station. I think he's going to play Saturday nights after this show. So if you miss it, you can go listen to it there. He also loops archives all the time. So they're going to hear me over there a lot. So luckily, I don't like to brag about this. And you guys know, if you're a regular listener, I've never bragged about this. But I am the number one paranormal show on Blog Talk Radio. Believe it or not, that's the truth. I'm typically always in the top 10 most popular radio shows on Blog Talk Radio. So pretty cool stuff. I've got a lot of people podcasting me. So hopefully I'm going to get hundreds and thousands of more listeners on Joe's network there. So really exciting news. I'm excited about that, people. I hope you are too. And thank you for everybody in the chat. I'm going to type thanks right here to the chat people. Thank you for all of your congratulations and stuff. I couldn't have done it without you guys. Good old buddies in the chat room. Chat's a lot of fun. So, all right. Well, let's move on to the guest. I do have a little bit of a Roswell special type of thing to do. However, I want to bring Don on to share this experience with him. And hopefully he doesn't mind because I'd like to hear his comments on this little thing I'm going to do. Well, but guess what? I am going to have to dial Don. And every time I dial, I think you guys know what that means. There's some dial music. And I know you've probably heard enough about Michael Jackson. A lot of people are like, I heard enough about Michael Jackson. But, you know, his music was extraordinary. So here's my rendition, which is, Mama say, Mama say, Mama makusa. 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 How's that go? Gotta get old. Ah, yeah. Stuck in the middle, and only pain is stuck there. Well, you gotta be starting something. Do, 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 do.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hey, Don, it's Alejandro.
Hi, Alejandro.
How are you doing?
Fine, how are you?
Great. Well, I'm really excited to have you on the show, and thank you very much for coming on. I'm just really hyped up. If people can't tell, I'm kind of being a little silly because I'm so excited for next week. But
it's going to be a fun week.
Yeah, it's going to be. And you live in Roswell, right?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, so you've got not much of a commute. Not like Grant Cameron, who's driving all the way from Canada.
Really?
Yeah, we told him we're
not.
That's
dedication.
Yeah, we told him we would pay for a Greyhound. Just kidding.
Yeah.
We offered to fly him. He said, "I'm driving. I want to see America."
Oh well, that's a good way to do it.
Yeah. Well, you have quite an interesting background. Your PhD is in English or mathematics?
Yep. It's in English literature.
Okay, in English literature.
But I'm a mathematician by profession, so
uh-huh. Okay.
I'm never been able to decide between the left brain and the right brain, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, that's perfect. I mean, the super geniuses are using both sides, right?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that I've ever been accused of being particularly well-balanced, but...
You also were in the Air Force, had top-secret clearance there, and you,
mm-hmm.
were Chinese language, but you also know Spanish and French?
Yeah.
You know, I'm embarrassed to say, with my name Alejandro Rojas, I don't even know Spanish.
I've always been kind of a language freak.
Cool. Well, that is really cool. And, of course, you're our state director for MUFON, which is great.
Yeah.
Well, I want to get
a lot of fun.
Uh-huh. Cool. I'm glad. Well, I want to get into a lot of this stuff. However, if you don't mind, I wanted to bring you on first. Just to get into the mood of Roswell, I want to play the original Roswell radio cast on the internet. I hope you don't mind.
No.
Of course, there's some people have probably heard this, but there's probably a lot of people who didn't hear this, so it's a lot of fun. So let's listen to that real quick, and then I'd like to hear your comments on it.
Sure.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army. Army officers say the missile, found sometime last week, has been inspected at Roswell, New Mexico, and sent to Wright Field, Ohio, for further inspection. Russia has demanded UN action to get all foreign military personnel out of Greece. Southern soft coal operators have not yet reached agreement with John L. Lewis, but the rest of the soft coal industry has resumed production. The House of Representatives has passed the tax reduction bill by more than the two-thirds which would be required to override a veto. Headline edition will bring you special reports and interviews in a moment. The American Broadcasting Company and affiliated stations present Headline Edition with Taylor Grant. From all over the world, wherever the day's headlines are made, Headline Edition brings you accurate, timely reports on the news behind those headlines, plus informative in-person interviews with the men and women who made the headlines today. Today's edition presents a roundup of the latest developments in the finding of a flying disc, an eyewitness report of today's significant action in the UN Security Council. Ohio Congressman Thomas A. Jenkins commenting on today's House action on tax legislation. A special report on the status of soft coal negotiations. And the details of today's All-Star baseball game reported from Chicago. Stay in step with history in the making. Stay tuned to Headline Edition. And now, here's Taylor Grant. Late this afternoon, a bulletin from New Mexico suggested that the widely publicized mystery of the flying saucers may soon be solved. Army Air Force officers reported that one of the strange discs had been found and inspected sometime last week. Our correspondents in Los Angeles and Chicago have been in contact with Army officials endeavoring to obtain all possible late information. Joe Wilson reports to us now from Chicago.
The Army may be getting to the bottom of all this talk about the so-called flying saucer. As a matter of fact, the 509th Atomic Bomb Group headquarters at Roswell, New Mexico, reports that it has received one of the discs which landed on a ranch outside Roswell. disc landed at a ranch at Corona, New Mexico, and the rancher turned it over to the Air Force. Rancher W.W. Brazell was the man who discovered the saucer. Colonel William Blanchard of the Roswell Air Base refuses to give details of what the flying disc looks like. In Fort Worth, Texas, where the object was first sent, Brigadier General Roger Ramey says that it is being shipped by air to the AAF Research Center at Wright Field, Ohio. A few moments ago, I talked to officials at Wright Field, and they declared that they expect the so-called flying saucer to be delivered there, but that it hasn't arrived as yet. In the meantime, General Ramey describes the object as being of flimsy construction, almost like a box type. He says that it was so battered that he was unable to determine whether it had a disc form, and he does not indicate its size. Ramey says that so far as can be determined, no one saw the object in the air, and he describes it as being made of some sort of tinfoil. Other Army officials say that further information indicates that the object had a diameter of about 20 to 25 feet, and that nothing in the apparent construction indicated any capacity for speed, and that there was no evidence of a power plant. The disc also appeared too flimsy to carry a man. Now, back to Taylor Grant in New York.
There was important activity within the UN Security Council today.
All right, well, there it is. It's a lot of fun to hear it. And it's interesting that they mention that the Air Force may be close to having more answers on this UFO issue. I mean, sounding like the flying saucer issue, it was a big deal during that time.
Well, you know, the thing that's really amusing about that is that reference to, the statement to the effect, now that you know, we've recovered this object, we'll be able to solve the mystery.
Right.
Well, you know, I mean, the mystery still isn't solved. You know,
yeah.
60-odd years later, you know, and we're still grappling with it. And I think if there ever was some misplaced optimism, you know, that, what in the world would make them think the mystery would be solved just because they had one? You know?
Yeah. Well, that whoever recovered that craft definitely has more answers than the rest of us.
But I'm inclined to agree with those investigators who say that the cover-up, you know, very likely is a cover-up of ignorance, because it's quite possible that the people who have the wreckage and so forth, you know, are still scratching their heads trying to figure out what makes it all work.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it couldn't be. I mean, we're probably talking about a technology that's so different from ours that, you know, it would be like dropping a Swiss watch in the middle of a settlement, in the Dawn Stone Age.
Yeah, I like the analogy that Stanton Friedman uses, where he talks about if you would have given Columbus a nuclear submarine, you know, they probably wouldn't have been able to make up their tales of it. Yeah.
What would you do with it? Yeah.
So what do you think about Colonel Corso's claims, then, that he helped distribute some of the pieces?
Well, certainly the notion that pieces were distributed around and various companies and various entities were asked to, study them and perhaps back-engineer them, that's quite feasible. I mean, given that, if you look at the technological curve, so to speak, you know, when did things start getting developed and so forth? Semiconductors, for example, were patented in late 1947.
Mm-hmm.
It's as if the whole technological curve just took this turn upward, you know, about that point. And so it definitely doesn't stretch my imagination any.
Right.
To suppose that there was a great deal of back engineering.
Yeah. And, you know, we're going to have, in Roswell, Paula Harris talking about Colonel Corso, and from what all I've seen, she seems to be the person who was closest to him while he was talking about all this stuff.
Right, yeah.
So she'll be showing some interviews that she did with him and talking a lot about that. That ought to be great.
Well, I think it will be, you know.
Mm-hmm. So living in Roswell, we had Jesse Marcel on last week, and I asked Jesse about Edgar Mitchell, because Edgar Mitchell, who lived in Roswell as a kid, he said that he knew a lot of people coming forward talking about what they saw and what they experienced, people who lived in Roswell. Do you have that sort of thing happening to you?
Well, of course, you know, as far as primary original witnesses go, you know, it was a lot easier. They were a lot easier to come by, you know, years and years ago than they are now. You know, we're playing a game of, I'm sorry to put it like this, but racing the Undertaker pretty much, you know, with still being able to talk to original witnesses now. But there, at one time, you know, there must have been a lot of people around who really knew firsthand, you know, what had happened here.
Yeah. Do you have people come to you occasionally that, hey,
well,
during the November?
I did have one new witness who had handled debris, and he didn't want to be identified. I wrote about him in the MUFON Journal, giving him an assumed name, you know, and he actually told the story of handling some debris when he was out on a hunting expedition with Mac Brazel. Brazel pulled this metal stuff out and said, let's prop this up against, you know, the bottom of a mesquite tree and shoot at it. And they were hitting it with a 30-06 deer rifle, you know, and flipping it up in the air and everything, and it wasn't even denting it.
Wow.
And this witness, as I said, you know, had a very, very vivid memory of that and didn't want to be identified.
Yeah, Jesse had an interesting story where he was, like, at a bar or something, and some guy was talking about how he was at the bar, and he was talking with some researcher, and he said, you know what, I put a couple of those pieces in my saddlebag. I'll have to show you one day. And then the next day, he said, people showed up at his door and said, you need to give us that material, and he gave
That's
it to
right.
him. And but yeah, the very next day, someone showed up.
Yeah, and the scary thing about that is, I know what I've been in that bar in Corona. It's kind of a landmark, you know, for the Roswell case, because as we sometimes put it, that's where he lost his loot. He had been picking up pieces, Bill Brazel, you know, and. The scary thing is that there would be somebody in that bar that much later, you know, listening to all of that and reporting it so promptly that it all got confiscated the next morning.
Yeah.
You know, that's pretty pretty scary when you think about it.
Yeah. How far back does your family go in Roswell?
My wife and I just moved here in 1996.
We're from
New Hampshire. I grew up in West Texas, but we lived in New England for many years.
Did you move out there to work at UNM in Roswell?
Actually, we moved back here, as I said, mostly because we just loved New Mexico, and of course, specifically Roswell because of our interest in UFOs. But yeah, I taught at the at Eastern New Mexico University, the Roswell branch here in town, until I retired a couple of years ago. Actually, I still teach there, but only one or two courses part-time.
Cool. Well, we do have someone who's in the chat who wanted to call in and ask a question, and it looks like he's here. So let me bring him on the air.
Okay.
And he goes by Man in Black. So hopefully he's not really Man in Black. Yeah, we'll find out real quick here if this works. Come on. Here it goes. Is Man in Black on the air?
Hi. Hello.
Hey there. How you doing?
Not too bad. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for calling. So you got a question?
I do. I have a few questions, if I can ask a few questions here. My first question is for you and your guest, and thanks to your guest for doing the show, and thanks for you for putting it on. Have you guys heard of a gentleman by the name of Ed Grimsley? And if so, what do you think of his research?
Do you want
to? What was his name?
Ed Grimsley?
He doesn't ring any bells right off the bat, no.
I have heard of him, and he's the guy who takes night scope binoculars and looks up in the sky and often sees stuff. I think that's worth doing. I mean, I've seen satellites I couldn't see with the naked eye with these things, and I think it's great that people are doing that, and I've seen some of his stuff, which is unexplainable. I think that's interesting. What do you think of that sort of thing?
I
think that's very good thing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's video of it on the website.
Yeah, he's got video on his website, so it's real interesting. Yeah, so did you have another question?
Yeah, just one more question. There's a few things that I believe we, without a lot of speculation, that we know about the UFO phenomenon. Obviously, I haven't done as much research as your guest, but as I take it, there's only really two things besides abductions and these other things that we really know. One is that they don't want to formally introduce themselves to us. They don't want to come down and shake our hand or park on the White House lawn. And number two is that they seem to have a higher technology than us. By these crafts moving around the way they're moving, it seems that they have a higher intellect and a higher technology than us. So keeping in mind that we only really know those two factors, or just for speculation purposes, if you could entertain me, what do you think that means, knowing that they don't want to introduce themselves, they'd rather just watch us and not show us their world, and number two, that they have a higher technology they don't seem to want to share with us?
All right, yeah, Don.
Well, I'm inclined to think that the whole business of not wanting to be close buddies with us, so to speak, you know, is in fact just part of the fact that they do probably have, you know, a very advanced standing technologically compared to us. It's kind of like if you were to go study a lower animal of some sort, you know, if you're actually standing there, you know, with a magnifying glass looking at an ant colony, you know, you don't say to the ants, "Oh, I'm Mr. Jones. Hello, Mr. Ant." You know, basically you stand there and study them, you know, because you have no reason to, you know, to even think about communicating with them. And it very well may be the same relationship with us.
Yeah, I guess you could say something similar with a lion in the field. We'll take them down, you know, tranquilize them, work on them, do medical experiments, and then put them back in the field. But we don't even have the ability to really converse with them.
Yeah, some abduction witnesses or people who you know claim to have been abducted have said that it shocked them that their interviewers, so to speak, the captors or whatever you want to call them, didn't seem to be too impressed with the fact that we could even communicate, that we could even talk, you know, that we even had a language.
Yeah.
I mean, it's as if, well, you know, you should be impressed with it, but they weren't.
That's funny. All right. Well, thank you, Man in Black.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
There's also someone else in the call queue, but their hand isn't up, so I'm not sure if you're trying to call in. I push a 1 if you want to ask a question, and that lets me know. Because sometimes people call in just to listen, which is fine, too, because you can listen on your phone. Interesting, too, that UFO Paranormal Network I was talking to, they say a lot of their listeners are streaming over their telephones and listening that way these days.
Mm-hmm.
Where the phone technology gets better. But what other sort of, you know, interesting cases or interesting stories do you have out there in New Mexico since you've been state director out there?
Oh, well, we get a lot of sighting reports. I got, in fact, about 3 weeks ago, like, I got 8 reports in 1 week, which is something of a record for us, I think. But and of course,
wow.
You know, as usual, a lot of these don't really end up being anything very, very definitive. But we have had some interesting things happen. I did my wife and I actually interviewed a couple of witnesses a few years ago about 100 miles north of here, where they had this strange kind of experience. And they didn't know what to make of it, and so they called at the time John Schuessler, you know, who was international director, and he called me. And we went up and interviewed them. They had been driving at night and had a lost time experience that involved an impression of driving in a spiral, you know, in a place where the road was straight, and of having lights spinning and so forth and so on. And we had quite a time interviewing them. One of the witnesses was very reluctant to actually come along. It was two sisters, actually. One of the sisters didn't want to come. And,
wow.
I like to see that, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I would rather see that than see witnesses overly eager to be interviewed because, you know, there's certainly no chance that the shy sister, you know, was just trying to, you know, be a wannabe, you know, or
right.
just get a name in the journal or something, you know, because she was reluctant to even talk to us. That's actually a good sign a lot
yeah.
of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when the people want to remain anonymous or reluctant. I know I read recently, I think in Roger Marsh had posted something about a sighting out there where people had seen jets chasing UFOs, possibly.
Yeah. Of course, there was that big hoopla in Texas, too, you know, in January of 2007,
mm-hmm.
with the jets chasing the object. I actually found a new witness to that one, and even though it's not my state, you know, I gave Don Ken Cherry a call and said, hey, you know, you ought to talk to this lady up, you know, northeast of Dallas, you know, if she had seen an object hovering over the lake there where they live.
Oh, wow.
There's definitely strange stuff in the sky. You just have to kind of
mm-hmm.
look for it.
Yeah. One interesting, and New Mexico so full of, it's my second favorite state, second to my home state of Colorado. I love New Mexico.
Yeah.
But and I've spent some time, my mom lived out there for about 10 years, actually, and I have family roots out there. And while she was out there, there was a guy who told a story about, he delivered furniture. My sister worked with him for a little while, and he would go out to the middle of the desert once in a while, and he wouldn't see anything until you get real close. You see a covered hillside with a big door there, and he'd mm-hmm. drop off furniture at these doors. And one time he got to go in, and he went on this, you know, hydraulic thing that took him down a few levels in these huge hallways. They had him drive the truck up and then drop the furniture off in one of these huge hallways.
Oh. Really?
Yeah. So.
You hear a lot of things about you know, underground structures and so forth. I had somebody... Actually, a military person told me one time that you can drive from the Army base in Fort Bliss, you know, in El Paso, up to the White Sands missile range.
Holy cow! Really?
Underground? Yeah. There's actually supposed to be a tunnel that you could do that on. And he said, "Yeah, I know about it. I mean, I've seen it." You know.
Wow! I'm sure it stays nice and cool.
I would say, you know, it impressed me, I think, more as a story coming from a military guy
mm-hmm.
who probably had reason to know, you know. And so, you know, there are a lot of stories about underground structures and tunnels and bases and so forth. The thing about New Mexico is we have one of the highest concentrations of places where there's classified work going on or has been going on, you know, of almost anywhere on the planet. I mean, you know, you start listing things like Los Alamos and Holloman Air Force Base and Sandia Labs and Kirtland Air Force Base and, you
mm-hmm.
know, all those places. And one can kind of understand why another race might be interested in having a look around here.
Yeah, I love looking at Google Maps, especially at Kirtland Air Force Base and the stuff in the mountains there, because like you said, there's Sandia Labs. There's also
mm-hmm.
Monsanto Mountain, which used to hold the nukes, and now you can
right.
see tanks and all these openings that go into the mountains, and then you see where they hold the nukes now in that big underground facility, and you see the most interesting things on the Kirtland Air Force Base when you look on Google Maps, and it's fun because... I remember flying into Albuquerque once, and there was a jet, fighter jet, that was landing right with us there.
I have reason to think that actually the Roswell wreckage was some of it perhaps temporarily taken to Carlsbad Caverns for storage until kind of the heat was off, you know, so it could be moved without so much hoopla and attention. Because Molly and I went down to Carlsbad several years ago and searched some old newspaper files, And we found out that about a week or a week and a half or so after the Roswell incident, there were all kinds of strange things, military groups coming in and out of town all the time.
Mm.
These little groups, you know, would show up and they would have lunch somewhere, and then they'd all get on a bus and go somewhere, you know, and then they'd come back like in an hour and get on an airplane and leave. And if you know, the waiters or whoever, or the hotel people asked them, where are you guys from? You know, they would say things like, California. You know, and you would say, well, where in California? And they would say, California. You know, and there seemed to be a sort of a little flurry of military activity there just about a week and a half or so after Roswell.
Wow,
and
that is really...
I'm inclined... Well, you know, Carlsbad Caverns has something in the order of between 50 and 60 entrances that are not available to the public.
Right.
It also has controlled temperature. It's the same temperature year-round. 57, 58 degrees all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wanted to get that stuff out of sight and have a look at it and then kind of wait till all the hoopla, you know, died down and then put a tarp over it and move it up, you know, somewhere further away, that'd be the temporary storage place and examination place that I would have picked, I think.
Yeah, and lots of, I know, even though the caverns that you can walk in are humongous, I know it's only a certain fraction that are available to the public even.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that was even more true in 1947. You know,
mm-hmm.
maybe actually less of it was open then than now, I think.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, that's another great reason to go down to Roswell, because Carlsbad Caverns is some amazing stuff. I loved going there. And,
oh, yeah.
And it's nice when it was 115 degrees out, I think, when we went, but you get down into that 60-degree cavern, and that's nice.
Yeah, it's pretty nice.
So let's get into the Marilyn Monroe research that you've done. How did you get into that?
Well, there had been that CIA memo, you know, about Marilyn,
mm-hmm.
that came out on August 3rd, 1962, just the day before her death. And that had been circulating for quite a while. I had a hand in actually helping authenticate that document.
Really?
And
so how did it come out?
Well, you mean how did the authentication come out?
Or no, where was the document found? Was it under Freedom of Information, or was it leaked?
Yeah, it was a FOIA release.
Okay.
And I actually at one point put in a FOIA request to the CIA for the wiretap transcripts on Marilyn's telephone.
Mm-hmm.
And for a copy of her diary, which disappeared from the coroner's office, you know, a couple of days after she died. And naturally, you know, I didn't, none of this stuff was released to me. But the interesting thing is, in the case of the wiretap transcripts, they said, you know, we don't find anything responsive to your request, and we're not releasing anything. So, of course, I filed an appeal. And when I filed the appeal, I based the appeal on the CIA memo, the CIA Marilyn memo of August 3rd, 1962,
mm-hmm.
which attached a copy of it and said, you know, it's because of this that I think, you know, you do in fact have, you know, the memo actually says that she, you know, her phone was being tapped. And so you must have those transcripts. And they accepted the appeal. They sent it to the agency release panel. At the time, George Tenet was running the CIA, and he and, you know, what happens was when it goes to the agency release panel, Tenet and whoever is running, you know, the agency at the time and the top people basically meet and they decide whether or not to release something. But the thing is, it doesn't even make sense to send it to the panel if there's nothing to release.
Mm-hmm.
The point is really that the memo, or rather the appeal, wouldn't have been accepted unless the agency regarded the document as legitimate, and unless they were willing to actually admit that it was theirs.
Right.
They don't accept appeals, you know, based on bogus documents.
Right.
So that authenticates the document right there.
Mm.
And I got interested in it through that, and I started really looking into it, and looking into things like Marilyn's boyfriend at the time she died, a fellow named Jose Bolaños, a Mexican screenwriter. who lived in L.A. actually at the time, and the fact that he had called her just minutes before she died. And then later, when Anthony Summers interviewed him in 1983, 21 years later, he said, Marilyn told me something that night on the phone that will one day shock the whole world.
Hmm.
That's an interesting thing because...
Yeah.
And it said will one day, you know, so it still hadn't, you know, is the point.
Right.
Look at the third sense of it. And it certainly, I mean, the whole world wouldn't be shocked by things like the fact that she was having affairs with Bobby Kennedy and Jack Kennedy and other people. I mean, nobody would be shocked by that.
They'd be shocked if they weren't.
Yeah, exactly. And the CIA memo actually said that one of the agency's concerns was that Marilyn was aware that Jack Kennedy had gone to a secret air base for the purpose of looking at, of inspecting things from outer space. I mean, the memo actually says that.
Yeah, maybe you could go over some of the other things the memo, for people who aren't familiar what the memo says.
Well, it basically talked about wiretaps on her phone and some other phones, people that she knew, and the fact that they were nervous about the fact that she was keeping a diary in which she apparently was writing down a lot of things that the Kennedys were telling her. I mean, it does make that very, very telling remark, you know, about mm-hmm. Jack visiting as an air base and so forth. The reason why, of course, I turned in that FOIA request, I knew that I wouldn't get, you know, the wiretap transcripts. You usually know you're not going to get things like that, but they would be spectacular. They would have to be. Because if, in fact, Marilyn told Jose Bolaños what I'm pretty sure she did tell him, you know, that's the last thing in the world they want to see on the front pages of the New York Times and, you know, the L.A. Times, which is exactly where I would have put it.
Yeah. Yeah, so what more did you discover with that? So what is your belief about how and why she died?
Well, I think that the afternoon that she, of the evening that she died, just a few hours before the fatal event, Bobby Kennedy went over to her house. He was in town for a legal convention, and he and Marilyn had a big fight because he asked her for the diary. He said, "Give me the diary. Hmm. You know, my family will pay you for it." There were surveillance tapes at her house that actually you could actually hear them yelling at her and saying, "I want that diary and I want it now." You know,
wow.
Where the blank blank is it? You know, and my family will pay you for it, and so forth. She threw him out of the house. To her credit. I think it's obvious that what happened was when he went back over to Peter Lawford's beach house in Santa Monica, and they kind of sat and licked their wounds, because actually Peter Lawford had been along too at her house at the same time, and he could be heard on the tape trying to calm Bobby down, you know. And I think Bobby figured at that point she had been talking about having a news conference, and in fact on one of the wiretaps she had been heard to say she was going to have a news conference and quote tell all unquote. And I think Bobby thought, you know what, if she tells the big one, you know, that Jack actually gave her classified information, I mean, he could be impeached, for God's sake. In fact, he could be actually indicted for treason. You know, the whole House of Cards is going to come down if she has a news conference like that. And I think he decided right then that they had to take her out.
Mm.
That they just had to take her out. And that's what happened. I mean, basically, Bobby and two guys carrying medical bags showed up at the house about 10:30 in the evening, and they ordered Eunice Murray, the housekeeper, and her son-in-law, who was the groundskeeper, out. They said, "Get out of the house. Go somewhere." You know, they went next door and watched through the neighbor's window, and then they saw these guys come out a little bit later, and they went back over to the house, and Marilyn was lying there dying.
Mm-hmm.
And her toxicology report later showed that her blood at the time of death had a toxicity density of 4.5 milligrams per cent pentobarbital and 8.0 milligrams per cent chloral hydrate, which actually would kill about 15 to 20 people.
Wow.
and there's no way in the world she got that stuff in her blood, taking Mindytal tablets. I mean, you know, she just didn't. You know, it wasn't that. You can't do that. It was not a suicide. Mm-hmm. It was murder.
Yeah, I had read a story in the L.A. Times. They did a couple stories, one of those being the first person who had done an autopsy was concerned, and he thought there was foul play because some of the stuff went missing. Some of her body parts and stuff went missing.
Well, and there's a lot of paperwork missing, too. The coroner's report started off being 750-odd pages long.
Wow.
And about 700 pages of that stuff disappeared.
Wow.
And it was brought to Lionel Grandison to sign. He looked at it and said, well, you know, this is not the file I saw. You know, this is not the paperwork I saw. And I don't think it was suicide. And he was told, just sign it, or things are going to happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
He told someone in an interview years later that was what he was told, basically. That,
yeah, I think this story covered that he had believed it was murder. He didn't believe that it was. And because of the things you cited, and I think they said they couldn't find out how it was done, that, you know, he found out it wasn't pills. And I think it said he believed it was a suppository.
Yeah, no, it was an injection.
Oh, an injection.
Yeah, it's the only way that biochemically it's the only way it makes sense. And it's fairly easy to conceal that. For example, if you do the injection in a hair follicle, it's very hard to find it. Very easy for an autopsist to miss it.
An injection in a hair follicle?
Yeah.
Oh, I've never heard of that.
It's just a point. I mean, you know, it's just a needle, you know.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
A follicle, there's about a 90% chance that somebody doing an autopsy will miss it.
Makes sense. Interesting. Yeah. So you believe then that explosive information she had was regarding UFOs?
Yeah. That's what the CIA thought, because they said so.
Mm-hmm. Oh, because it talked about where Jack Kennedy had gone.
Yeah, and the fact that was one of the big secrets, you know, that they were nervous about.
Uh-huh.
And you know, the fact that they actually more or less unwittingly authenticated the document for me by accepting my appeal.
Uh-huh.
You know, in effect, they have said that UFOs were the problem.
Mm-hmm. Who originally submitted the original FOIA request to get and receive?
That I haven't been able to find out. I know that Timothy Cooper had the document early on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he may have done the original FOIA request.
Mm-hmm.
The document was originally in his hands and in the hands of the Milo Spiriglio Detective Agency in Los Angeles very early on.
And were they involved? Were they hired by someone to look into her death?
Not that I know of, but they were involved. I think either Tim Cooper or someone close to him, you know, actually got the document through FOIA.
Uh-huh. Yeah, wow, really interesting stuff. So,
I seem to be kind of fated, you know, to write books that attempt to rescue people from the clutches of a secrecy obsessed government, you know, kind of like too late to do them any good. first it was Marilyn, and of course my most recent book is about Robert Oppenheimer, who also got shafted over UFOs.
Yeah.
That's going to be the subject of my talk at the festival this year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, they didn't kill Oppie, you know, but they did yank his clearance. And they almost might as well have murdered him because he was out of, basically, he never worked in his field again, you know, after they did that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't want to get too into that because I'm trying to get our listeners to come down and hear you talk about it live in Roswell.
Yeah. It's been an exciting thing to work on.
Yeah, and maybe you can review who, for some people, who Oppenheimer was.
Yeah, he was basically in charge of developing the atomic bomb at the at Los Alamos during the Manhattan Project in from late 1942 to mid-1945. He was actually, General Leslie Groves was in charge of the project, but he had to have, of course, a scientific, chief over the whole thing, and he chose Oppenheimer. And Oppenheimer, of course, did develop the bomb. As you know, it was tested on July 16, 1945, successfully, and a similar one was dropped a few days later on Hiroshima. And basically, at the end of World War II, he was a national hero of a type I don't think we've seen since,
mm-hmm.
or before, or ever any other time. And yet, he was betrayed by his own government.
Mm-hmm.
Very sad.
Well, and what's the official story about how he fell from grace?
Well, the official reason that the Atomic Energy Commission's Security Board gave for refusing to reinstate his clearance was questions over his loyalty, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The people in his family had been communists and back in the 30s. Didn't see the bother of them when they hired him in 1942, but...
Mm-hmm.
They were concerned about the fact that he had kind of dragged his feet over the development of the H-bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And he had explained all of that during the hearing. He said, "I'm not disloyal because I have doubts about the H-bomb. It's just that I don't think, I think what we need is tactical weapons, and that's not a tactical weapon."
Yeah.
He
was very hesitant about its usage, and I know there was a little bit of a almost a mutiny where scientists on the project were really concerned about its usage.
He was certainly not alone being reluctant to do it. There were people who said we absolutely should not, build a weapon like that.
Mm-hmm.
But there were people out to get him. Hoppe actually made a lot of enemies.
Mm-hmm.
He caused a lot of his own problems. He essentially just made enemies with people that he shouldn't have made enemies of at times, and they didn't forgive him for it. And when it came time for a vendetta, they didn't hesitate to partake in one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's unfortunate. I'm sure projects like that, it's difficult not to make enemies, especially with the military when you're during a war, when you're trying to advocate peace. And
that's right.
Einstein even wrote a letter, didn't he, to the president eventually about...
yes, he did.
...usage of the bomb?
Yes, he did. And in fact, funny, when they told Oppy that they were suspending his clearance, Eisenhower suspended his clearance in December 1953, and they told him a few days later, he was traveling in Europe at the time, when he got back, they told him, and they gave him one day to decide whether to fight it or not, just to go home and forget it, or go through these security board hearings, personnel board hearings, to see if he could get this clearance back. And he decided to fight. And when somebody told Einstein that Oppy was going to fight it, Einstein said, "Well, you know what Oppenheimer's problem is? He's in love with a woman who does not love him. And that's the United States government."
That's a great answer.
Yeah, what a great line, huh?
Mm-hmm. Einstein's got a lot of them. I love using his quotes.
His
wit and his wisdom are just incredible.
Oh, yeah, amazing, amazing guy. Mm-hmm.
And speaking about Einstein and Oppenheimer's relationship, they wrote a document to the president about how to deal with extraterrestrials. Isn't that true?
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Yeah, they did. And which is just another reason to know that Oppenheimer was involved in all this.
Mm-hmm. And what was the nature of that document? What were they telling the president?
Well, basically, it was just a document describing the probable nature of life elsewhere and the fact that one has to approach studying it a certain way and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
It was a rather telling kind of document. There are other documents. There are documents that show Oppenheimer as an advisor to Majestic 12,
mm-hmm.
And that sort of thing.
You know what I think that's funny about the Einstein-Oppenheimer letter was they went over law. They talked about the legal ramifications and and about international law and the creation of interstellar law and all of this stuff getting caught up in courts. And it's really, I've never heard since anybody talking about, you know.
Possibly with the exception of that time, you know, President Reagan told the United Nations that it might take all, to unite all of us here on this planet, it might take an adversary from space.
Yeah.
You know, I remember he made a remark like that to the United Nations one time.
Yeah, but and that doesn't really get into the politics of the law, which is funny, you know. We'll need, not even the what's called exopolitics, you know, gets into that sort of thing.
Right.
Which is what that implies, you know. Interstellar law, and it seems like, you know, that's something you would need to address in some way, but it's kind of funny where...
The legal side of this whole business is fascinating. In fact, I devote a chapter in my Oppenheimer book to the fact that there's really no legal basis for government secrecy except executive orders.
Mm-hmm.
Funny, presidents aren't supposed to make law, but they do.
Well, and all those so many of those executive orders, especially with the Bushes, both of them, are secret, and you still don't know what they were.
And there is nothing in constitutional law and nothing in statutory or appellate law that says anything about the government's right to keep everything secret.
Mm-hmm.
Not a word. Everybody thinks it is, but there's not.
Well, and that was a great thing about the Disclosure Project and their lawyer, Danny... I cannot remember his last name right now, which is a bummer because it's great. That was his premise. He worked on the presidential files, the Pentagon files, and other things, but that was their premise, that those secrets, those oaths that they took in the military to keep those secrets were illegal because those projects were illegal. They didn't have
it. At least lacking a legal basis. If not illegal, just not legal, you know, maybe.
Right, not legal. But, you know, speaking of that as well as space law, you know, people in the chat here were talking about the moon and crashing that satellite into the moon like they want to do. And they were talking about legal law or the law around space, and someone was like, there's such thing as space law? And a lot of people don't know that there is international space law, and especially just like any international laws, lately the U.S. just ignores that they exist whatsoever, such as I know part of space law is you're not supposed to fly satellites over other countries and take pictures, and if you do, you have to share those with that country.
And I'm sure everybody really obeys that one.
No weapons. There's supposed to be no weapons at all in space.
Which, if you've ever seen the movie Meteor, you know probably about how that goes.
So there is international space law.
Yeah.
Do you think Oppenheimer or Einstein had anything to do with those laws?
It's conceivable that they maybe precipitated some of that, with that memo, I think. Einstein was taken fairly seriously in government circles.
Yeah.
More than Oppenheimer was. I think Oppenheimer was kind of a hothead, you know, and people tended to be a little afraid of him, you know, during that whole business of his being questioned about, you know, loyalty and so forth. Eisenhower and his friends kept him away. That's the same time the Army-McCarthy hearings were going on, and Eisenhower and his cronies kept kept Oppenheimer and Senator McCarthy apart. Deliberately, they didn't let McCarthy go after him because they knew that if McCarthy and Oppenheimer were ever in a room together with cameras, it was just going to be a bloodletting. I mean, you know, Oppenheimer would just cut him to pieces with a big audience. You know, they didn't want that to happen, so they kept them apart.
That's too bad.
Yeah, it would have been funny to see.
Yeah, he had it coming, that McCarthy.
Yeah, for sure.
So with Eisenhower, what is your belief about what Eisenhower knew, and if he really did, you know, handle these events, Roswell, and all of these?
Oh, I think that most of these things, you know, we have the stories of Eisenhower going to a place and looking at wreckage and whatnot. I think the stories of his fairly pronounced involvement in the UFO question are almost certainly true, valid, because for the simple reason he was an ex-military man.
Mm-hmm.
He had lots of connections.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, actually, the fact that he was elected in 1952 and Harry Truman wasn't president anymore made a big difference, because if Truman had stayed president, I think it could have been different. But when Eisenhower came in, all the military guys had to say to him, no doubt, you know, was, hey, Ike, remember that favor you owe me?
Mm-hmm.
Remember when we served together, you know, and so forth, and we needed to kind of sit in this thing for a while longer. And I'm sure that the secrecy thing is much easier to keep going with him than it would have been with Truman.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, and, you know, that I think being a military man, his speech when he left office is really, I think, pretty incredible, and a lot of wisdom, which we're suffering from not listening to his wisdom. When he talked about watching out for the dangers of misplaced power in the defense industry.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, hindsight, you know what they say about hindsight, it always being 2020.
Right, exactly. Majestic 12, you mentioned with Oppenheimer, and of course, that was supposed to have started during the Eisenhower years, right?
Well, yeah, actually, the common understanding, I think, is that Truman first appointed these people, and Oppenheimer never was at least according to the list we see and everything, was never a member, but I have seen one memo to the effect that he was an advisor to them.
Mm-hmm.
But these were people that just went across the lines, you know, when one president was replaced by another, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There probably still is something like Majestic 12 with new people on it and everything.
Mm-hmm. So you do believe that Majestic 12 did and possibly...
Yeah, I think the work that Stan Friedman has done on that, you know, to validate that, stands pretty well, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, really, you know, I've got his book, and if Stanton says something, of course, he's skeptical of a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But if he puts his stamp of approval on it, you know that he has done a lot of research.
Yeah, and has overcome his own skepticism to do so, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right. Which is
skepticism being, of course, the healthy attitude about everything. You know, if you start off saying, well, I'm not going to believe it until I'm convinced, then if you are convinced, it really means something.
Yeah, well, and that's science. I mean...
Yeah,
you come
exactly.
from a skeptical perspective. That's what you do in science.
Exactly.
So JFK, then, what do you believe about his knowledge in on the subject of UFOs?
Well, if we, you know, can believe that CIA memo, which I think we can, because as I said, I kind of got the CIA to authenticate it.
Mm-hmm.
He knew about it. I mean, you know, he had seen. Probably debris and bodies, and you know he was in on it. There have been rumors, of course, for years that the thing that got him assassinated might have been that he was going to declassify everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the type of person. You know, if you said to him, "Well, you can't do that," he would say, "Yes, I can."
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that may have been what did him in the end.
Yeah.
So there were rumors immediately after his assassination that the CIA was involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
I used to wonder why they do that, you know, but
there
are actually pretty defensible reasons why they might.
Yeah, I know.
Defensible from their point of view.
Right, from their point of view, exactly. with JFK, you know, there's been, I think it's been Michael Sala and or Alfred Lambert who have been writing about, speaking of exopolitics, about JFK opening up our space exploration with Russia to work together on that, and that there were suspicions that he was also then going to open up UFO files with Russia. Have you heard much about that?
Yeah. I've seen, of course, the famous memo where he talks about just safety. You know, he says the Soviet Union and the United States and other countries have to know about unidentified flying objects because failing to identify one could start a nuclear war. But what if something anomalous shows up in the sky and country A thinks that it's country B firing nuclear missiles at country A, you know? And you have to know the difference. You have to know the difference between a known and an unknown. And there's a fairly detailed memo about that that I've seen.
Yeah. It reminds me, I think I mentioned this last time, because so much of that era and that stuff reminds me of Dr. Strangelove. I just love it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's all, it's just to have lived through that time is quite an interesting thing. I mean, there was a lot of tension, you know, there was a lot of paranoia and very, very strange times.
Yeah, I know. There's a gentleman, Kent Storch. I don't know if he's a MUFON investigator and a police officer out here. And actually, before this Discovery Channel television show, did you catch the UFOs Over Earth shows?
No.
Oh, that's too bad. I've got them, and I think I could copy them. And I think since they're not being distributed, we can probably, I'll see if we can distribute those. But because that was, it was focused on MUFON, the Discovery Channel shows. But before that, there was actually another pilot shot of MUFON investigations. And this guy, Ken Storch, is police officer, MUFON investigator, was the host of those. But he was in the military, and he says he was part of an incident where they did catch a UFO on radar, and they were really scared, and they were ready to push the button, and they were watching these things, and it changed course.
The missile couldn't.
Yeah, it changed course and went towards Canada, and he was thinking, well, let them nuke Canada as long as it's out of, you know. But they were happy that, you know, he said it was a really tense moment.
But that's quite a valid point. I mean, you know, the governments can't afford not to study UFOs. They have to. I mean, we've got at least a couple of countries in the world right now, you know, threatening nuclear war. And, you know, a country just has to know what's in the air. You know, they have to know the difference between something that's supposed to be there and something that's not supposed to be.
Right.
And something that's man-made and something that isn't.
Yeah. Well, with all those tensions in the Middle East and with North Korea, you know, if they saw a UFO, what would they do? And launch on Japan or another ally?
So anytime a government says to you, we're not interested in UFOs, you know, your correct response is, you can't be that stupid. Of course you are. You have to be.
Yeah. Well, and the beautiful thing is that a lot of countries do admit that they're interested in UFOs.
Yeah. Brazil, Mexico, France, Belgium.
And, you know, with that's what's great about, you know,
England.
Nick Pope, he'll be there with us in Roswell. And he'll be talking about Britain opening up the files, which is great because Nick did a lot of conferences this year because of all the British news. But the British news has died down, and Nick hasn't talked in a few months. And I know there's more that's gone on, so we're going to be able to here to catch up on some of that stuff. But
It's going to be exciting.
Should be great. And then, of course, we sprung something on you that I haven't talked to you about yet. I know Free did, so, and another thing that hopefully you're open for doing, I and if not, that's fine too.
Oh, those little
workshops.
Yeah, I've signed up to do two of those, and I'm looking forward to them.
Cool, great, because I'm going to write up an agenda, but you can do what you want, and also bring a disc of pictures, so we can go over a lot of pictures with people. I think people love UFO pictures, and I downloaded a bunch of them from a British paper that put up like 25 great UFO photos.
Well, I actually had planned too with my sessions to talk a little about the Valet classification system for people.
Oh, cool.
So we can see how we determine what kind of sighting, you know, a sighting is.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And if you need it, I've got a clip of Alan J. Hynek in Close Encounters.
Right, yeah.
Because
I've actually done a number of sessions on the Flat Lake system, you know, at various, like, at statewide MUFON meetings. And
oh, cool.
Just to be sure everybody understands how it works. It's a neat system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, somebody had to put something together. But so out of, I guess, getting into some of the speakers and stuff out there, well, I was going to ask something about MJ-12, but more about that. Oh, it was John Alexander. Do you know of him?
I can't quite recall the name, no.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you about that, but it already sounds like John Alexander worked for the military, and the news I gave earlier is they're creating a movie loosely based on him. George Clooney's going to play him, actually, and it's going to be a dark comedy. And they asked him to look into different paranormal subjects, and he did. And his thing is mostly psych warfare and non-lethal weapons, which is kind of scary stuff, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
But he goes to – people invite him to UFO conferences, and he talks about how the government doesn't know anything about UFOs.
Oh, well, they know they better know about it.
Yeah, they better know something. exactly. So, but, you know, you had mentioned MJ-12 and stuff, so you certainly don't seem to agree with that perspective.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So some of the other speakers that are going to be out there in Roswell, so we can get some people excited about that.
It's quite an interesting lineup. I know international director James Carrion is going to be speaking, and also Clifford Stone, who's a government documents expert.
Mm-hmm. And he lives there locally, right?
Yeah, he lives right in town. I've known Cliff for years. He's an old friend.
Uh-huh. Oh, cool. Great. Yeah, he's got some fascinating information.
Yeah, I've seen Cliff. I actually had Clifford do a talk at a statewide MUFON meeting one time, and he, of course, this guy has got hundreds of thousands of pages of documents, you know, that he's pried out of one government agency or another over the years.
Mm-hmm.
He's really into it.
Yeah. Well, and because he's a local, because he's a nice guy, and I have all of that information, I knew luckily nobody's made an issue of it. I thought people were going to give me a little bit of trouble over inviting Cliff for our talk because he's so highly controversial.
Well, but you want that. I mean, you know, without any controversy, what would this field be? You know?
Yeah, be boring.
Yeah. Pretty much.
We might as well just be a knitting club.
Oh, yeah. Can't do that.
Yeah, so I was really excited to bring him on. He's definitely probably one of our most controversial guys there. And then Travis Walton, have you ever got to see him?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've actually never met Travis Walton, but
yeah.
I'm hoping to see this coming weekend. Yeah, we're glad to have him coming.
Oh, yeah, definitely. He is so down to earth and such a nice guy. And that is one of the things that's great about meeting Travis Walton. You know, he doesn't have some kind of polished talk. He's still, up until very recently, he was talking about stopping, but I don't think he has. But up until recently, he's still a lumberjack, you know, working 10, 12-hour days out there, hauling logs, cutting down logs and stuff. So, yeah. So, and you meet him and you know how old he is, but he's, doesn't look it. He's still really fit and, it's great to see him talk about his experience and see what kind of person he is and just how down to earth he really is.
Yeah, which of course just gives his account, you know, all the more credibility for anybody to not even think about not believing that it all really happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
It had to.
Yeah.
It's kind of like Betty and Barney Hill, you know. I mean, how did they fake that? You know, they couldn't have.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about this theory? You know, the caller called in and talked about abductions. I've heard lately from some abduction researcher, he believes that Betty and Barney Hill was not an extraterrestrial abduction, but a military abduction.
Well, anything's possible.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really, that's a hypothesis, it doesn't really account for everything.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't account for Betty's star map, for one thing.
Yeah. This is Joe Monteldo, and I hope to have him on the show to talk more about that, because...
yeah, that'll be interesting, yeah.
Yeah, he says, I know you're probably skeptical, and yes, I am, but...
No, but, you know, the thing is, this is how science works. Science works by competing hypotheses, you know. And,
right.
And looking at which ones account for everything best.
Yeah, and that's what I love, and that's why, you know, I love the openness, and why we should listen to Clifford Stone and all these guys, because exactly
yeah.
like you said, science doesn't start with listening to witness testimony and saying, oh, that's not possible, and blowing it off.
Right.
That's not science, and those scientists who do that are not good scientists.
That's right.
Science is taking that witness testimony, the observed phenomena, and trying to put a hypothesis to it and test it and trying to figure it out.
Exactly, and that's why, you know, it's really a delight to see the field moving in that direction. You know, for so many years, the field of UFO studies was considered kind of suspect by a lot of people. You know, it was considered like not really valid or not real science or something. And now we're actually, I think, beginning to make it clear that it is science.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be.
Yeah.
That's what it has to be.
Yeah, I know at MUFON there's some of us working on a science conference with a typical, you know, scientific symposium. They've written up the call for papers and mm-hmm. trying to have it kind of like a SETI conference, but beyond, because we're going to entertain, of course, more hypotheses than SETI would.
Right, yeah.
And I don't know...
Relatively good.
Yeah, and I don't know if you saw this, but the only place I saw it was in a blog where this guy does news on SETI and stuff like that, and he blogs on UFOs and things. He went to the SETI conference last year in France, and there were two scientists, one from France and I think one from Italy, and they both talked about UFOs in their SETI talk, which SETI I'm sure didn't appreciate. One of them talking about how they're here, and he was talking about how it's probably this, he was hypothesizing on why they don't interact with us, and he was kind of same as what Stanton Friedman talks about. They're probably containing us because we're wild animals, observing
exactly.
us at the same time.
Yeah.
So that was interesting. And then another one, who was talking about how we really need to look at UFOs because they're here and people are seeing them, and, you know, that's where we're going to find some more information.
Exactly.
So,
the only way anybody can claim that there are no UFOs is to demonstrate that every single object ever seen anytime by anyone anywhere in the sky has been positively identified as something familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And that is simply not possible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, by definition, a UFO is simply something in the air, and we don't know what it is, you know, and heaven knows. There's a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it.
Yeah. And
I mean, I can't imagine anybody saying, you know, denying that there are things in the sky we can't identify.
Yeah. Well, and that's what's great. You know, I remember when Dan Aykroyd came out with his video talking about UFOs, which is a great video. People got to get that. He's done a lot of research, and some ufologists are like, oh, that's basic stuff. Well, maybe, but you may know it. Yeah, exactly.
You know, to the public, it's probably not so basic.
Exactly. So he does a great job getting out some information. He sounds like a seasoned ufologist.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he has reason to know where he speaks.
Yeah. So when he came out with that, they were talking on CNN, they interviewed him, and they asked him about it. And I think they had Bruce McAbee on. And the lady was like, and, you know, there were something like 3 or 4 sightings in the United States last year, weren't they? And, you know, and
really?
I think, I'm pretty sure it was Bruce McAfee they had on who talked about, well, actually, there's a lot more, and you can go to MUFON.com and see more. And he didn't say how many, but, you know, there are thousands. I mean, we're getting thousands of reports. And I know when I became an investigator, I was surprised and delighted by the credibility of some of these people I went out to go investigate.
Yeah, I have been too. I've worked on a number of cases where I was just really gratified to see that it was something of substance, you know, and that I was working on something that was obviously real, you know. It's a privilege. It's a privilege to be able to work on these things.
Yeah. You know,
listen, Alejandro, I'm going to have to sign off.
Okay.
I've got to get up early tomorrow morning and do some things. But I just want to tell everybody that this year's bash, I don't know what else to, I mean, it's going to be a really nice festival, I think. We have a big lineup of speakers and lots of events. We have these orientation sessions, I think, are going to be a lot of fun.
And,
you know, like somebody said, be here or be nowhere.
Yeah. Can I ask one last question real quick?
Sure.
You know, a lot of investigators, and actually we're out of time anyway, but a lot of investigators talk about, you know, what percentage of UFOs reports are actually unknowns rather than something mundane that's identified. What's your number?
Well, I don't have hard data on that. I'm over the years, I've gathered the impression that something on the order of maybe 3% of cases are truly anomalous, and that's stupendous because, I mean, even if let's say there were only 1,000 sighting reports in a given year, and there are many, many more than that.
Right.
But if there were only 1,000 sighting reports in a given year, that's 30 real UFOs.
Exactly.
And 30 really anomalous objects.
Yeah, I heard
Mickey. That's 3% or whatever that little percentage is that really makes life interesting.
Yeah, that's pretty much what Michio Kaku has been saying lately.
Yeah.
Well, great. Thank you so much for being on the show. I can't wait to see you.
My pleasure.
In just a couple of days here, we'll have a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's coming and it's going to be fun.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's hot out there, huh?
103 today.
Holy moly, so shorts and t-shirts.
Believe it or not.
I'm not going to be fancy next week.
No, 103, so.
Wow,
It is the desert.
Yep. Okay, well, thank you very much, everybody.
My pleasure.
You can go check out the website Black Mesa.
Oh, yeah, www.blackmesapress.com.
Blackmesapress.com, and you can get his books. And check it out and come hear him talk in Roswell. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Look forward to seeing you.
Yep. So just to do the rundown real quick on the other speakers that will be out there in Roswell for the listeners here. Like we've talked about, James Carrion, director of MUFON, Travis Walton, Don Burleson, who we just talked to, Paula Harris. We'll be out there talking about Colonel Corso, like we just talked about. Clifford Stone, who we just talked about. Nick Pope, I think we covered everybody. Oh, I didn't cover Chuck Zukowski, who I had on. Roswell researcher, who we'll be talking with his sister, Debbie Ziegelmeyer, and they're going to be doing our Roswell 101, covering the basics for our visitors who aren't up to speed on all of that. Grant Cameron talking about presidents. Claude Swanson, a physicist, talking about equations that were downloaded by Stan Romanek somehow. And Richard Dolan, he's got a brand new book coming out calling Exposing the Cover-Up, Past, Present, and Future. I'm going to be in Roswell next weekend, and I'm going to be so busy, unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to do a show. I apologize, ladies and gentlemen, but I'll be back in 2 weeks. And I'm already going to be up on the UFO and Paranormal Network in the next couple of days. So they'll be playing some of my archives on there. So the Australians are going to be getting a dose of UFO Think Tank Radio. I hope they like it. Anyway, you guys have a wonderful weekend. Come say hi. If you're in Roswell, I'm going to be at the MUFON Talks, and I'd love to say hi and meet some of you. But thanks again. Talk to you guys later.